The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report special with Magic Johnson. We just watched your documentary, The Announcement, and tell me, what was it like to relive 20 years later, 21 years later, I guess, that time of your life?
Well, Bill, it's always, I guess it's great now that you can relive it, that also that you've lived over 20 years with the virus. You know, back then it was an emotional roller coaster. The announcement, you know, when I found out, it just devastated me. And so I had to deal with that myself, making sure that I would be okay. And then, you know, the hardest part of the whole thing was to go through that almost two-week time, a week, so to know if my wife was going to be okay. You know, and I was just like, that's the thing that really I was like really praying that hopefully she'll be fine and the baby would be okay, because she was pregnant at that time. And when we got the news back that she was okay, that was a heavy load lifted off me. Now I knew I could go on and deal with it myself and try to make sure that I would be here a long time. And then, you know, not understanding who cared for you in terms of who was going to be supporting you, who was not going to speak to you. And I think the other tough thing was when some of the players came out, they didn't want to play against me and they thought they would get HIV. I think that was really tough too.
Yeah.
So it was some, no question, it was some tough times. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm here. I thought it was important to come public and tell everybody about my status. And I'm glad, because I was able to help a lot of people. But, you know, to relive it, it's always tough seeing yourself on the screen. you know, that's the toughest thing. But, hey, I've been here. I've been blessed. And that's all that matters.
You had to deal with it as a public figure and a private figure, which I think watching that documentary made me think. Like, I'm just thinking of you as, oh, crap, he can't play anymore. He's got to deal with that. And
right.
And meanwhile, you have this whole other thing going on with your wife and
mm-hmm.
figuring out if your baby's healthy, all that stuff.
Right.
You said that was about 10, 11 days. At that same time, you were kind of, nobody knew where you were. And they were saying you had flu-like symptoms
right.
and all this stuff.
Right.
You're back in practice.
Right.
At what point did you feel like people were starting to think, wait a second, something weird's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
Or did you ever feel that way?
I never felt that people felt something weird was going on. During that time, we were trying to find out and make a decision, what was I going to do? First, was I going to go public with it? Second, was I going to retire? And so I had to make two really big decisions, you know. And so once I knew I probably should retire,
yeah.
Then I had to decide whether to come public or not. And Cookie and I discussed it. But Elizabeth Glazier, really, who was dying of AIDS at that time, really was a person who helped me to, first of all, deal with my new status of having HIV. Second, to help me understand how important my role would be in the HIV and AIDS fight. And then she said, you know what, Urban, you got to go public. So it was really her educating me about the HIV and AIDS fight and getting me to understand that I could become the face of it and really help save a lot of people's lives if I went public. And then she helped Cookie really settle her down to say, hey, Urban's going to be here a long time. And when she told Cookie that, I think that really helped her. Because in the beginning, she didn't want to go public.
Yeah.
She didn't know how people were going to treat me and respond. So once Elizabeth talked to her, then it was okay, and that's why we came public.
Looking back, though, I mean, can you imagine if you had tried to keep that a secret for 6-9 months? I mean, wouldn't you have been living in fear every day that, you know, it was going to get outed basically by some anonymous source or whatever?
Yeah, and also, too, I've never lived in fear. I don't know. That's not me. It's not my makeup. I've always faced every challenge that's ever, you know, been put in front of me. And so I'm happy because coming out public, then I can just deal with whatever. Even if people didn't want to touch me, hug me, high-five me anymore, I could deal with that. But trying to hide it would be probably tougher than actually going public.
Yeah. And, you know, I look back at how I dealt with the news at the time. I had really no idea there was any real difference between HIV and AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even, you know, I know HIV was a term that was used.
Right.
But I think for a lot of people, and I probably include myself, mm-hmm. there was a general ignorance about, mm-hmm. you know, what it was. Is it the same thing?
Right.
Oh, Magic has HIV. That means he's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember thinking, he's got 2 years left, three. Mm-hmm. Now, 20 years later, you're sitting here. What did you think you had left?
Bill, you were thinking like everybody else. I bet you 90% of America was, and the world was thinking the same way. Because you at that time, you didn't really separate the two. It was just AIDS.
Yep.
And so I didn't know, you know, because I asked him, is somebody, another athlete who you know of, who I can look at him or her to see what happened? And they said no. So I couldn't go with that. So I was just going to do everything Dr. Ho and told me to do, and I was going to take my meds, I was going to work out, have a positive attitude about it, the things that he told me to do, and but I never thought I was going to die.
Because, well, I mean, you were one of the all-time competitors.
Yeah.
I must say, hear like, yeah, you might have 3 years. I'd be like, all right, I'll show you.
Exactly.
You go in that mindset, right?
Well, that was me. That was my mindset that when they told me I wouldn't be able to play point guard in college and in high school, they told me I couldn't do it in the NBA, I've always had a challenge in my life. So this was just another challenge. But the difference is it's life and death, where then it was just a basketball game. Or proving something in sports. But I never really thought I was going to die. I think that I felt good. I was making sure that I think that if I probably wasn't a religious guy, I probably wouldn't have thought the way I thought. But I thought that I was going to be blessed and I was going to do everything I had to do to be here for a long time.
And the part that I think is fascinating is, so you get this contract, 25 years, $25 million, I think in 1981, right?
Well, it was right after that.
Right after your rookie. So the only reason you even had this physical mm-hmm. was because that contract went from making you, you know, the most highly paid guy in the game
mm-hmm.
to now you're woefully underpaid and they have to rectify this.
Right.
And they give you this contract. You get the thing. I mean, when you think about it, what a divine twist of intervention there.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, again, the man above was looking out for me. And then I'm glad we had the physical because early detection actually saved my life.
Yeah. How much longer do you think you could have lived with that without knowing before it would have just blown out into something worse?
Nobody knows. There's
yeah.
no timetable, but you knew that you got to probably about a year to 10 years, at the end of 8 years, you know. But there's no timetable. But I'm just happy it all worked out this way because now I could get on a regimen, taking my meds, making sure that I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do. And that's why we urge people to go get tested because early detection could actually save your life just like it saved my life.
Right. And with the basketball thing, you go from – you're playing every day, I guess, from what age? Like six, seven?
Yeah, seven, five, six.
through college, NBA, 12 mm-hmm. years. All of a sudden, it's shut off. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
You can't play. I mean, just from your structure of your life, that must have been the most jolting thing of all, right?
Yeah, Bill. It was actually worse than finding out I had HIV because you're giving up the game that you love. You were at the height of my career.
Yeah.
I love being the point guard for the LA Lakers.
You also had the Jordan thing. Jordan had ascended to the top. Yeah. He'd won the finals from you. Right. Now you spend the whole summer thinking you get revenge on him.
Yeah, I was looking forward to, you know, seeing Michael again a few more times. And also, too, it's just the love of the game, man. Even today, I love NBA. I love basketball. And it, all of a sudden, it's gone. I can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
And I was depressed behind that. That took me a long years to get over that I couldn't put on the purple and gold anymore. And I couldn't go out there and play the game that I love. And when I was coming to the Laker games, that even probably made it worse for me because I was seeing myself out there again. And so that was the most difficult thing I had to deal with. You know,
yeah.
I thought taking the medicine and all that would be difficult, but actually once I got used to that, that was it took me a year to adjust to have to take meds.
Yeah.
That's the hardest thing. It's just reminding yourself you got to take it 3 times a day back then. But it was actually just watching those Lakers play without me. And what you miss the camaraderie of the guys. And then you miss that crowd reacting to the past, the no-look pass. You miss running out there. And then you miss playing in a big, big game, especially in the playoffs. You miss that.
And that was a great stretch for the league, too. I mean, 91, 92, 93, I think mm-hmm. the league was as talented as it ever was.
Yeah.
And the 92, 93 seasons, which you missed,
mm-hmm.
you came back a little bit. But
right.
That would have been really interesting to see how those teams played out.
Yeah.
You know, I think you the documentary didn't totally capture this, but from the announcement through those next 5 years, like it seemed to me like you were a guy who was struggling a little bit. Like mm-hmm. you came back as a player, and then that didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
You came back as a coach.
Mm-hmm.
You announced.
Mm-hmm.
You did a talk show.
Mm-hmm.
Then you came back
mm-hmm.
again in the 95-96 season.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like you were just trying to figure out where you fit in
mm-hmm.
beyond just being an HIV spokesman. Is that a fair statement?
No, I think that, you know, you missed the game, so you want to come back. And I was still a young man. And so I think that it's fair to say you're trying to figure out your life.
Yeah.
And the talk show definitely didn't work out. And I really have more respect for guys who do that on a nightly basis and guys like yourself who do it on a daily basis as well. So that wasn't me. But at the same time, what people didn't understand, I was still a businessman. I was still owning things.
Right.
But it wasn't publicized. Like, the talk show was, you know, a big thing. And so coming back to the NBA was a big deal. But I was still owning businesses as I was doing those things. So right when I got fired by Fox doing the show, I just went into my business life and also just said, you know what, I'll forget basketball. I'm going to concentrate on my business and building my empire there. And I just took off. And it was almost like, look, man, you can't play basketball anymore. Knock, knock, you can't play.
Yeah.
So get that out your system. Just go over here, and you're going to be blessed with this incredible business because that's what you always wanted to do after you were done playing basketball. So I'm just happy I got into my second life. And ever since I got fired from the Magic Hour,
yeah,
my business just took off. So it was great.
The coaching thing, I think you went 16 games.
Yeah, but I never wanted to be a coach.
All right.
I did a favor for Dr. Buss. He asked me to go down and
so
coach.
So deep down, you never want to do that
anymore? Oh, no. I would have done it then. And only reason I did it was I love Dr. Buss. And when Dr. Buss asked me, and if he asked me anything to do, I'm going to do it because I love him. And so I was fighting, kicking, screaming all the way to the practices and everything.
Yeah.
I never wanted to be down there. So we won our first game, right? So we play, and everybody's going crazy. And Dr. Buss, Jerry Buss, all of us, you know, hey, great job. You know, we won, blah, blah, blah. So I call, at that time, Lon Rosen was my agent. Now he works for me. And I call Lon into my office, you know. I stepped out. I said, hold on, you guys. I said, Lon, get me out of here. I'm miserable. After the first game. And I never in my life, I respect now the Phil Jacksons, the Pat Rileys,
I'm really surprised, getting to know you a little bit at least, and just knowing what you were like as a player. Mm-hmm. I would have thought you would have liked coaching.
No.
Just the leadership of men type aspect of the whole thing.
If I would have liked coaching, I would have stayed, because they wanted me to stay.
Yeah.
Jerry West.
But why don't you think you liked it, though? Just dealing with egos and all that crap? Or just wanted to play?
Because I've never wanted to be a coach. Yeah. And I know how difficult it is. Your heart and soul has to be in it. I've always wanted to be a businessman after I was done.
Yeah.
So Michael Cooper, Byron Scott, myself used to sit side by side. Our lockers, on planes, on buses, everywhere. We'd go to the movie every road trip together. So Coop said, I want to coach women's basketball. He's coaching at USC women's basketball. Byron Scott said, I said, what do you want to do after you're done, Byron? Oh, I want to coach in the NBA. He's coaching, you know, Cleveland now. And I've always said I wanted to be a businessman, and I'm doing just what I want to do.
Right.
Now, you take me in a boardroom or you put me in those situations, I love it.
Right.
Not coaching.
Post-Olympics, you came back. It's covered in the film a little bit, and you know, there was definitely hesitation on part of some players, and I'm sure you heard rumblings of other players and things like that, that everything culminated. You got cut in your arm.
In North Carolina at the exhibition game.
And in the doc, they say how, you know, people are saying how you felt, you could feel people looking at you differently.
Yeah.
Explain what that was like.
That was a tough moment. You know, everything was going good up until I got cut. And the hush over the crowd, and then every eyeball was on me, that cut, how I was going to react. And I'm looking at them to find out how they're going to react in terms of the crowd and the players. And
you could feel it.
Oh, man. You could definitely feel it. And Bill, I never felt that way ever in my life playing basketball. It was like I didn't belong, you know. And so I went back, and you almost wanted to cry. You know, you were so disappointed that that happened. And I knew then I had to retire again. I had to step away, because I never wanted to hurt the game or be this almost like a
polarizing force,
and then to keep forcing the issue, I didn't want to do that, so I'd rather step away. And that's what I did, to say, forget it, it's not worth it. It's not worth it to my teammates, to David Stern and the NBA, and also just putting everybody in an awkward situation. They weren't ready. Everybody wasn't educated. They were not ready. And then I wasn't ready to deal with, you know, after cut. I'm also just like going crazy too. So that's why I stepped away, and that's why I came back later. Because David, you got to give Commissioner Stern a lot of credit. He actually helped educate the league and the players about HIV and AIDS, and I was doing my part. And the next time I came back, everybody was more educated. They were ready, especially after what happened in the Olympics. It went well.
Yeah.
And I remember even in the Olympics, Australian guy said, you know, they didn't want to play against me. They hope if the Dream Team was playing them, a couple of guys were like, well, I'm not going to play against them, you know. And then we end up playing them and blowing them out. But, you know, even then it was a little, that was the one country who said some negative things.
Could you feel people playing differently against you?
No, not at all. It was just that cut changed everything.
Right.
You know, and I think that made everybody maybe say, uh-oh, maybe I can get HIV from playing against them.
Right.
That changed the whole thing.
Right.
And so
what about the way people were interacting with you, like, post-November 7th? Like, because you're a lovable guy. You're a guy, you're a hugger, you're a toucher and all that stuff. And you're at a point in the world where we didn't know how HIV was transmitted and all that. Did you feel like people were
There was
backing off?
It was definitely some hesitation, no question.
You still see that now or not?
No,
anymore? No.
Now it's just like, man, come give me a hug, come give me a kiss, give me a pound, give me a high five.
Yeah.
Back then you had to go, and people didn't know what quite to do. You saw that hesitation. Oh, should they shake at my hand? Should they not? Say, give me a high five like they used to. It was all that, You know, and so you just say, okay, just smile and you go about your business, you wave, and, you know, but it was definitely hesitation. And then, you know, you had three guys, I think Mark Price and Karl Malone, and I can't remember the other one, came out and said, hey, they didn't want to play against me. So that also put fear in, I think, some of the other players as well. Mm. And then I think the All-Star game actually changed a lot of their minds, the way, you know, I was able to perform and play, then nothing happened. Then the Olympics followed that, and then that's when I came back.
If you had to do it over again, that 18 months or so after the announcement, what do you think are like the two biggest mistakes you made?
Not continue to play.
Oh, really? Coming out of the gate?
Yep. I should have stayed with it.
You mean stayed with it like that season?
That season.
Really?
Yeah.
Don't you think the same thing would have happened with the cut? I mean, you would have just had that moment a year earlier.
Should have stayed with it, though. Even if the cut came, then you just retire or do what I did, but I should have stayed with it.
You really feel like people were ready at that point in time to deal with something that they still didn't understand?
Well, it still didn't matter. Even when I came back later on, they right. wasn't ready then, so you might as well should have just came out the gate and still played. You know.
So how do you see that going then? Maybe you take a month off and come back? So like come back in December?
You know, maybe so. I can't tell you how it went. I'm just saying what I know today versus what I didn't know then.
Right.
You might as well should have just Got played it. Right away. But, you know, I think that I'm talking about for me.
Yeah.
Was it the right decision what I did? Yes, it was the right decision not to play and go through all that.
Right.
But you're asking me today, 20-something years later.
Knowing what you know now.
Yeah,
I see what you mean.
Yeah, so you say, hey, you should have just tried it right out the gate. But I made all the right decisions. I don't regret anything that I did. I'm happy that I retired because I wanted to be here for my wife, Cookie, and my kids. Because at that time, they couldn't tell me. They said, hey, it's going to attack your immune system, so you got to be strong. And an 82-game season would hurt, you know. And so that's why I retired. And so I'm happy. Everything that I did, I'm happy.
Would you have gone in the book that I think the book came out a year later, and you know, it seemed like you really went out there trying to tell people, like, here's all the stuff I did, talked a lot about your sexual escapades, mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you went too far or not far enough?
No, you tell the truth.
Yeah.
You know, so I told the truth, and we dealt with it, and because you got to tell the truth and you got to educate people.
Right.
You know, I went far enough. It's no go further. That's it. You go as far as you go, and that's it. You try to educate people because you knew that there was players and other people living the same type of lifestyle, so you want to educate them, but also guys, normal guys.
Right.
And so you tried to educate everybody.
What about there? You know, you're battling all kinds of rumors after you got HIV. You went on Arsenio's show. Mm. Arsenio asked if you were gay. You said no. Mm. The crowd applauded.
Mm-hmm.
In retrospect, kind of not the greatest moment.
Well, he put to rest what people were trying to say. So it was a good moment to ask me that question to say, yeah. Hey, whether I am or not. So, you know, I think the gay community, I think, probably took it wrong at that time.
Yeah.
But the heterosexual community wanted to know. So what do? You ask the question. And that's his job, is to come out and ask questions. And then I joined forces with the gay community to help educate people about HIV and AIDS. Because one thing good about the gay community, they did a wonderful job of educating themselves and their community about HIV and AIDS, where the heterosexual community, we've learned from the gay community on how to educate people about HIV and AIDS.
Do you think
and also safe sex?
Do you think we needed somebody of your stature / celebrity to really advance this cause to the next level? Because up to that point, it had been, you know, Arthur Ashe. And,
did
we need somebody on your level to do this?
Yeah, in the prime of career and playing for the Lakers and so on. I think it definitely helped. And that's what Elizabeth Glazer told me. She said, you know, that's why it's a perfect time for you to be the poster of HIV and AIDS, because we needed somebody like you. And that's why she didn't want me to just go away and keep it a secret. She wanted me to come out and tell people. And I think I did help, and I'm still helping. It's You know, the HIV and AIDS fight has been an interesting fight because, you know, when I first announced, everybody wanted me to join them because they had their own agenda. And so when I joined the Bush Commission, America was not really doing a lot when it came to HIV and AIDS back in the day.
Well, that started with the Reagan presidency. Yeah, I mean, he wouldn't even acknowledge it.
Yeah. Until. And so it came on through. I decided to quit and got with some great grassroots organizations who were doing great things about HIV and AIDS. And so when you think about it, a lot has been done. We still got a lot of work to do when it comes to HIV and AIDS, but the drugs are better. One, when I announced, we got, what, over 30 now. The information is better. And you and I can sit here on a show, on your show, and talk about openly about HIV and AIDS. Well, we couldn't do that before.
Right. What do you think is the biggest, in 2012, the biggest misconception about the virus?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that when I first announced how everybody was really protecting themselves and really getting the information, it's not at the forefront like it used to be. And that's what we got to change. We got to get it back at the forefront. People are still getting HIV today. But the drugs are better, so people are living longer, especially if you can get early detection. But there's still a fight out here. It hasn't changed. And then the world now, you know, Africa, China, some of the bigger countries and places there, HIV is popping up over there at an alarming rate.
Before we started taping this, you presented the film to a bunch of high school kids in Los Angeles, and you were talking to them, and you kept shushing them. Mm-hmm. You wanted their full attention. Yeah. Do you feel like when you're talking to these kids, mm-hmm. they're locked in 100% to what you're saying, mm-hmm. or has the impact of 20 years ago faded a little bit here?
No, you're going to always shush kids. Anybody.
Right.
The principal, their teacher.
That's a good point.
That had nothing to do with whether they're listening or not. I connect with kids very well. That's why I was able to deliver that message to them.
But do you feel like 20 years later, and I was, I get it, HIV is bad. Do you feel like it's still resonating with those kids?
It's resonating, but it doesn't hit them because I'm too young. So they feel they're too young to deal with HIV and AIDS right now. Even though young people, the numbers are up among teenagers who are diagnosed with HIV. So that's why we're going to deliver that message to them. And then I think the film itself will do a wonderful job with them. And then the panel, because there's some people who are on the panel who got diagnosed when they were 14, 15. So they will also connect with them. So I've always connected with young people because I'm real. I keep it real. And so if you keep it real and then they know that you're really there for them and then you don't talk over them, over their heads. And I never talk over their heads. And so, and they know I'm from the community. They see me and they see I'm the same color so I can deliver the message to them. And so it all works.
You know, the most interesting thing about you is that you no longer play basketball, but not for the reason that people think.
Yeah.
You don't play basketball because you can't find a good game.
Exactly. You know,
I think this is amazing. How could you not find a good game?
Well, you know, I'm in such great shape. You know, a couple of years ago, I said, you know what, I'm too heavy. So I purposely lost about 30 pounds. I wanted to get in great shape. So I increased my cardio, and then I got better at what I was eating.
Yeah.
And now I'm like in the best shape of my life, right? And what happens is now they play, but they only play for an hour. But if they say the game's going to start at 10, it actually don't start till 11, 11:30. And my day is all programmed out.
Right.
It's all penciled out. So you can't tell me 10 because I'm going to pencil 10 to 11:30. Then I got to go to meetings. And so I can't find a good game. But I still love the game because.
Can I ask you who shows up late for a pickup game with Magic Johnson? I want to meet this person. If Magic's coming at 10, I'm there at 9:30.
Young people have changed. It's not the same.
I'd like to apologize on behalf of all young people out there.
Exactly. Some of them, you know, 10 is 11. But at the end of the day, hey, I still love it. It's still the game that I I watch and
do you still have it, you think? You still have the little baby jumper?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was shooting about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I was shooting like a magazine cover. And I started shooting some shots. I made about 10, 11 in a row. And that never leaves you. Yeah. That's why I tell you that Larry Bird could come. He still can shoot. That never leaves you. Michael Jordan could come and play right now. And not in the league, I'm talking about. But if he was shooting or something, it would be unbelievable because that never leaves him. And passing and what I do would never leave me, ever, because that's what I do.
I think you should start a Legends League.
No, somebody
you guys spending your own money.
Hey, somebody would get hurt, you know. I got a present for you.
You have a present for me?
Yeah, I got a present for you. Because I was tired of you being a Celtic fan, so I bought you your own 32. Look on the back. Look on the back. Sweet.
Oh, my God.
Sweet. See, now you tell all your Celtic friends that you just crossed over to the Lakers, baby. That's for you.
Oh, my God.
That's for you, my man.
I don't know what I'm not afraid to touch this.
Yeah, well, you better touch it. And you better put it next to Larry Bird's jersey. I know you got probably McHale.
My head's going to explode. I can't even stare at this.
Probably Havlicek. You probably got Cousy, Russell. You probably got all the Celtics at your house. So now you got one Laker can go up in your house. You needed some color in your house. You needed some purple and gold, not that green and white stuff.
This brings me back to 2010, the confetti falling on me after Game 7, just wanting to be anywhere else on the planet. I forgot to ask you one thing, and then we're gone.
All right.
Pat Riley worked you out.
Mm-hmm. In New York.
And did you ever think of becoming a Knick?
Yes.
You did?
Yeah.
92-93
yeah,
Knicks.
Yeah, we had been talking about it.
You and Pat.
Yeah, Pat and I. And actually, I talked to Dr. Buss, and Dr. Buss said, if you're coming back, you're going to come back a Laker.
Yeah,
no
he didn't
way.
Like that.
No, he didn't like that. No way you're going to. I'm going to let you go to the Knicks. But Pat worked me out. Matter of fact, every time I saw Pat, he would work me out. Pat is one of my best friends in life. And I owe a lot to Pat because when I announced and retired that day, he had a great moment for me in New York. And the crowd and the people in New York really, you know, said prayers for me, and a great moment. And I thank Pat for that. And then every time I came to New York, he worked me out. And New York is a special place. Great basketball fans, and they always really give me a great ovation when I'm there. So Pat Riley is my man, you know. And
so
will
it could
be.
Have been Ewing, Starks, you. I think Doc Rivers was on that team.
Yeah.
Charles Smith.
Yeah, and
Knicks fans just grown to Charles Smith. I think Xavier McDaniel was on that team.
Yeah, so that would have been great. And Pat was trying. He was working me. And now even today when he sees me, he looks, okay, let me see if you got any stomach on you, if you're in shape.
Ought to help the Heat.
Pat Riley.
Let's make some news. Magic's coming back.
No.
They need a point guard. We covered it earlier.
He's 52 years old.
I think he could still run the half court.
And he's comfortable. Oh, I could pass it to a guy, but I couldn't get back on defense. I can't move left to right. And I'm happy with my life. Trust me. I'm happy being a husband, a father. I'm happy being a businessman. I'm happy to be the poster child of HIV and AIDS. But I don't want anything to change my life. My life has been great, you know. And even going through this, I wouldn't have changed it. 20 years, 21 years later, I wouldn't change a thing.
Irvin Magic Johnson, thanks for sharing your story with the documentary, and thanks for being on the BS Report.
Oh, thank you for having me, man. And remember, the purple and gold. You got to put me up in your house.
Never.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.